You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Hi folks, it's Fran here. Welcome to this week's conversation where we're looking at the readings for Pentecost 2, the second week of after Pentecost. We've had several weeks with New Testament readings and Psalm readings, and we're going right back into the Old Testament with 1 Samuel 8, verses 4 to 11, then verses 12 to 15, then 16 to 20, and then chapter 11, verses 14 and 15, and the Gospel of Mark. I haven't heard from Mark for a few weeks. We're going to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 3, verses 20 to 35. And we're going to start with Samuel, aren't we, Robin? So can you fill us in with a little bit of background where we're up to the kings?
We are, or we're about to get to the kings. So this is the first of a series of readings from 1st and then 2nd Samuel we're going to get. So it is a great chance to take your people through an Old Testament text, and there's a lot of wonderful themes that emerge from this reading. Mm. We're here at the beginning of Samuel, or towards the beginning of, in our Bibles, 1st and 2nd Samuel. In Hebrew Bible, this is just one long text because the story keeps going, so two volumes. We're in the Promised Land. The people have the covenant with Moses, but Moses has gone, Joshua has gone, and then we've had this period of leadership of the judges, and that's narrated really in the biblical book of Judges. And towards the end of Judges, if you're familiar with that, we get story after story of just how bad things are. Mm. There's violence, there's chaos, there's injustice. And so generally what we're getting here is a sense that judges are not working. That's the sort of background. And what we're going to see emerge in Samuel are some key figures. We start with the prophet Samuel, who's Hannah's son, dedicated in the temple and raised in the temple by Eli, really, whose own sons were disappointing. So Samuel takes on his prophetic leadership role. Samuel's sons, we're about to learn, are also disappointing and corrupt. But Samuel will commission the first king, who is Saul, and then ultimately King David. So we're entering this period of kingship, and it's that our story really starts to introduce today with this request of the people for a king.
Which makes it quite distinctive, doesn't it, in sort of the ancient world, because it's normally the request for a king, or a king would emerge on God's initiative. So in the Code of Hammurabi, yes, Marduk says, the deity Marduk designates Hammurabi as a king.
Yeah.
Whereas here, so it's coming from below, from the people.
Yeah, and that's a really important thing to bear in mind, because we're going to end this text down in verse 19, I think it is, where one of the reasons the people want a king is to be like the other nations. But actually in requesting that, just to jump to the end, they're requesting something that is almost giving away the gift that is their own relationship with God, because the other nations in the ancient Near East, as you said, the God appoints whoever their human agent is to act for God. And the whole reason Israel have not had a king is because God is their king. Mm. They have this much more intimate and direct relationship with their deity, which they're almost giving away. They need something
concrete and visible. At this point, I'll just make a brief reference to the 2 Corinthians reading, which we're not covering in the podcast in any great depth, but verse 2 Corinthians 5, verse 1, and in verse 18 in chapter 4, there's this whole dynamic around we look not at what can be seen, but what it cannot be seen, for what can be seen is temporary, and what cannot be seen is eternal. And for we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God that is eternal. Mm. So there's this whole dynamic around the visible and the temporal and the eternal and invisible, which is kind of what's happening with Israel in this Samuel reading, that they've been given this great gift of a close, intimate relationship with God, but it's not concrete enough for them.
No.
They want something they can see.
Yeah, and it reminds me, and this is a bit of Robin interpretation, not something I've actually read in an official scholar, so take it with a grain of salt, but I couldn't help but think of the golden calf episode in terms of having some similar dynamics where the people want to build a God that they then worship as Yahweh, because God feels absent or God feels too distant or perhaps too terrifying and holy. There's a number of nuances to that. But it's what you've said, like it raises all sorts of human questions here. So maybe let's get into the text a bit.
Yeah, sure.
If you're going to preach on this, I don't know why you wouldn't just start at the beginning of chapter 8, because the fact that Samuel is old and he had set up his sons as judges, which is an interesting phrase because it actually suggests that on the one hand he's trying to create his own dynasty, but his sons are – they took bribes – and they twist justice is the language there. Because it's interesting when the people, the elders come and request in where our passage starts in like sort of chapter in verse 4, the elders come and request a king. They do so precisely because his sons have gone astray, they say to Samuel. And Samuel seems to take this a bit personally, that the Hebrew there is literally the thing that they've requested is evil.
All right. We've just got displeased in the NRSV, which is a bit
weaker. It's a colloquialism. Yeah. It's evil in his eyes, but in it's not a good thing.
He was pretty annoyed.
And God basically says, don't take it personally. It's not about you. It's about me in what follows. What did you notice in the text, Fran? Is there anything you want to point to?
In the text itself, no, I've still got a big picture view of it, I suppose. Just thinking about the whole notion of monarchy, I suppose I hope that's okay, going to the sort of how you might approach this and how the monarchy, if you're an Australian in particular, we do live under a monarchy that we don't give much thought to because it's not particularly relevant to our day-to-day
it's the British
lives.
Crown, yes.
But the notion that, and you know, why people critique it is because the leadership is inherited. It's not earned. It's not because you've got some, you know, sort of competency. And what we're seeing in the royal family is a real critique from within at the moment. Just thinking about human frailty and what Harry's doing in talking about the reality of what it was like to grow up in the fishbowl. And so I guess for me this passage brings up a whole lot of stuff about human capacity for goodness and for discernment and for leading. God seems to trust that the people can discern and lead together. That's partly why God doesn't want a king, want it in one person. But as we see in the modern narrative of monarchy, there's a lot of frailty and it's all set up as this representative thing, but there's all sorts of ordinary problems that are leading to sadness and and so on.
And that's because, I mean, for me, one of the takeaways of this passage is that any human system of governance is imperfect.
And we do need a sense of order, but in a way, sometimes our grasping for it is, I don't know, what's that about? It's trying to keep things in order, but it's also trying to avoid the sin and the corruption that we know is at the heart of humanity. And I'm thinking now of two stories. We know of The Lord of the Flies, the book about the boys who on an island ended up living in a tyranny under a leader and cruelty. And that's a fictional story. But there's also a true story of six Tongan boys in the 1960s who bunked off school, six boys between the ages of 13 and 16, and they bunked off school and stole a fishing boat and went out for a fish. And they went missing. They got lost. Anyway, everyone thought they were dead. But they were on an island for 15 months and they were discovered by an Australian fisherman. And they'd actually created a really peaceable community. They had prayer time every morning and they did not turn into a Lord of the Flies. It was quite notable, apparently, how they'd created community for themselves. So just as to say, we are fickle and frail.
But also capable of great good and wisdom when we live with God, which I think is part of, if I can bring us back to the text, and that is a beautiful story and we'll put a link to where people can find out more about that, the Tongan young men. You know, in verse 8 here where God talks about, you know, he says to Samuel, it's not about you, it's me they've cast aside from reigning over them. This is the core problem with the request for kingship, is it's a rejection of that relationship with God. And yet the theology here is quite lovely. God does this at a few key points in the Hebrew Bible of God saying, you know, but it's what they want. I'm not going to talk them out of it kind of thing.
Oh, and it's almost like a parent saying, look, I don't, this, it's going to go badly, but you need to find out for yourselves.
So we'll give you some forewarning. I mean,
yeah, so I can say I told you so. When it goes wrong.
See, I was right. Yeah. This is why you should listen to your God.
So, yeah, that is, it's very, I mean.
It's quite permission giving of the deity. So, I mean, it isn't a tyranny, right? That says something about the character of God in itself. And also it reflects, again, very human traditions in the cultures around them, where the warning Samuel then gives that God's prompting is, this is how kings behave. They take your young men and send them out to war. They take your young women, and I think the NRSV has something about turning them into perfumers. There's some suggestion that this is actually basically take them into their harem.
Oh, right.
You know, that there's various ways.
Loose living.
You serve the king, and that's one of them. And it would be an honour in some cultures, but you're still taking your daughters into the king's harem and, you know, taking them to work in their fields and the best. The king will take the best of your. And again, here there's the play between the human king and God because the
God
whole.
God provides.
Yeah, and the whole system of offering is you give your best to God, right? You give your the perfect ram or the first fruits of the harvest. They go to God, and now he's saying they're going to get taken by the king.
I'm really struck by how forceful it's described that the people refused to listen. They said no.
Yes.
It's not, there's no pleading.
No, they're just like, no. We want a king. Yeah. Yep.
So that we may be like other nations.
Yes, and that those last two lines, I mean, if we go to preaching themes, there's a whole sermon just in like, we want to be like other nations. Like,
there's a song from the 1960s where a line goes something like, I want to have a little bomb like you do. I want to have a little bomb like you.
Yes.
My parents had it on a record, folks. I don't remember.
I was going to say, Fran, you're not that old enough to remember
that. My parents, but I do remember that line as a seven-year-old listening to it.
And, I mean, that can work in both negative and, I mean, here I think it's meant negatively. They're looking at others and going, we want what they have, and in the process of that, disregarding the unique thing that they have. But we can also look, people who work in multi-faith spaces, I can't remember who first said this, talked about, you know, holy jealousy. We can have holy envy towards the traditions of others. Mm-hmm. So this can also have a really positive element. There's something to play with there. And there's something here that's, again, very human about wanting a king to fight their battles. Nobody wants to be powerless, right? Mm. They know that change is needed. And I think there's a whole lot to play with here about there's a desire for change. There's recognition that the current system isn't working. This might sound very familiar to some of you and your churches. And instead of seeking closer relationship with God and what God wants, they demand what they want on the basis of human wisdom. And I mean, a million examples come to mind of the way the church does this all the time, whether it's looking at corporate business models on the one hand, or, you know, in the Uniting Church, we often just like to reshuffle and keep reorganizing things as if that will solve the problem.
Or pulling out another committee. But then other churches will go, well, a bishop can do that, you know.
Yes, yeah.
You know, investing it in one person. So, yeah, certainly there's a lot of sermon material there about how we order ourselves in church life as well.
But it's not to say the desire for change and the recognition that things aren't working, I think that's a good thing because we can also be so change averse. Mm. So how we have a conversation with our congregations about, but how do we do that in a way that seeks what God wants instead of here the problem is human insistence on what we think is best. Mm.
And trying to change the system at the most logical point, which is the leader, and that's not always where you start.
No, that's true. It's not going to change the culture necessarily.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find the link at our website, fatherwell.com.au.
So we're into Mark's Gospel again, having had a bunch of weeks' break, and we certainly are back in with a vengeance. We have a classic Mark and sandwich story.
Yep.
And a couple of things really stand out to me. What's said about the family that challenges a lot of traditional Christian views about the family, but also the stuff about what God won't forgive.
Yes, which we need to address because that has all sorts of problematic resonances.
So prior to this, Jesus has appointed the 12.
Yes, he has, yep.
But the authorities have started to really realise he's a problem.
Yep.
Is there anything more you want to say about the lead-up?
No, well, just to say in that little bit before this where they appoint the 12, you know, he gets to Judas Iscariot and Mark has added this, who betrayed him. It's like a do-do-do-do.
Spoiler.
Yeah, which, you know, in a way is redundant but maybe sets us up for the conflict that's about to happen with all this metaphorical language about a house divided, right? Mm. That every human house here, even Jesus' 12 disciples, can be a house divided, like, yeah, you know, so there's just something in that little.
Well, that is also echoes something into the Samuel reading about the kings, but we've.
Yes, it does. Yeah, yeah. There are some themes that run across if you want to do with them. Mm. But let's do some exegetical points, perhaps. His home, so this is probably Capernaum.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in the Galilee region. He's in a house, and this reference to not having time to eat is simply about the hastiness. Like there's this, you know, this marked sense of urgency and crush.
Yeah.
Pressure.
Jostling.
Yep.
Yep. The crowd's like a character, really. In this story, well, generally, but it's a crowd, is a character here.
Yep. There's a Greek word in verse 21. The NRSV has his family, and I think this is his biological family. They try and grab hold of him, and they're saying, and I think the Greek, the most plain sense interpretation is not the people were saying, it's that the family were saying, but it could be either. He's gone out of his mind is what the NRSV has. This is this ex-istemi word, which can have a sense of literally being beside himself, we would say in English, like when someone's beside themselves with grief or beside themselves with joy, or like you're utterly changed. It has a sense of there's been a fundamental shift in someone. Which I just mentioned because gone out of his mind can be a it takes us into kind of mental health, maybe in unhelpful ways, but we might return to that. So I would probably translate this as he's utterly changed. There's something about Jesus that's not recognisable here.
Is a less loaded, culturally loaded way of putting it.
I think so. We should note in verse 22, the scribes have come from Jerusalem. Now, the scribes are going to have huge conflict with him later.
Another house divided. Well, he's pointing out division. Yeah, he's creating division in the house.
Yes.
By pointing out their faults.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's also quite astonishing that they would come from Jerusalem. They're leaving the big city and the epicenter of faith to a regional town because they're so concerned. So this is another like dramatic moment, if you like. Beelzebub.
Yes, or Beelzebul. Yeah. I read somewhere that's like Lord of the Dwelling in Hebrew, but that didn't really help me explain why they would choose that word.
Well, there are Hebrew phrases like Prince of Baal or
that makes sense.
Lord of – like Baal can mean Lord or – so it's hard to know. But here
– we'd say boogeyman maybe. Our generic term for
– Well, Jesus answers the accusation by using the language of Satan, and we have other texts from this period, like the Qumran texts that talk about Beliar as leader of the demons. So there's a number of different names, if you like.
It's the otherness. It's the other from God.
A demonic leader, if you like. And the other key word is this parables word in verse 23. So what these sort of rather cryptic sayings about how can Satan cast out Satan, how is a kingdom divided against itself going to stand, which can all seem a bit like, what are you on about here, Jesus? It is introduced with this, you know, he spoke to them in parables, which here it's a sense of parables as metaphors. He's trying to make a point. We shouldn't take this literally is what I'm trying to say. We can get to the strong man in a moment. Is there anything else you noticed, Fran?
No. I wondered about the property and the tying up and the binding.
Yeah, that's also super important.
So the binding, the word for binding is also the same word in Greek as used in chapter 5 of the exorcism of the demon.
If we work with these metaphors Jesus is using, so the strong man is just another metaphor for Satan to go into the strong man, the powerful person's house. It does have both apocalyptic and political kind of dimensions to it.
And, I mean, here portrayed Jesus is the stronger man who does the binding up. Yes. And that's in line with what John the Baptist said of him in chapter 1, verse 8, about
yes.
one greater than me is coming.
Yes. So Jesus is the stronger man in a, mm. in a kind of a cosmic battle of forces mm. going on so, here.
Which is, again, very Markan.
Very Markan with other exorcisms, as you've pointed out. So the binding, it's interesting because we have other texts like 1 Enoch 10 talks about, has God instructing the angel Raphael to go and bind up Azazel so that, you know, again, these demonic forces can stop harming people. So in there it's mm. in the context of the angelic realm looking down on earth and seeing all the wickedness and the bloodshed, and God's solution is bind up the evil. So this binding up, a bit like in the exorcism story, is a way of saying we're going to stop the
disempower
the evil. And it, in that sense, it's apocalyptically part of the activity of God incarnate.
Mm. I also note that Mark's drawing on the image of breaking and entering, which is from
interesting,
you know, quite a lot of eschatological stuff in Christianity, and that the God is talked about as like coming like as a thief in the night in Matthew and Revelation and in Thessalonians. So there's in my previous reading of this passage, I hadn't noted that.
Yeah.
And it does all fit together a lot clearer when you think about that tradition behind this imagery.
Yes, and it makes sense of the imagery, which can otherwise seem really
odd random,
that
a little
Jesus
bit random.
Is talking about himself in this kind of way.
Yeah.
In verse 28, we get to this verse about the forgiveness of sins, and this has an afterlife that can be really unhelpful. People have speculated about what's the unforgivable sin. The Greek here is in verse, where am I? Verse
28.
Yeah. Is like almost an eternal or an ongoing sin. Or verse 29, whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit cannot have forgiveness but is guilty of an ongoing or eternal sin. Mm. So not quite the same as unforgivable, but there's something here about the crime of the scribes in this story is that they've got the presence of God right in front of them, and that it's not that they're just ambivalent or neutral, but they actually label it as evil. So it's a complete mislabeling of divine activity.
So one summary could be, couldn't it, that God is mercy and forgiveness in God's self, and they're rejecting that as goodness.
Yep.
And so therefore that's a blasphemy, and therefore they're not to be forgiven. And that makes sense. It's saying, well, if you don't see forgiveness, you don't accept it, then you don't have it.
Yes.
So there's a certain internal logic to the sentence.
Yes, and it does also take us back to that baptism story in a couple of ways that you've already alluded to, because there, of course, the Holy Spirit comes upon Jesus.
Mm.
And so the blasphemy against the Holy Spirit here is, I think, precisely that the Spirit, that they can see that Jesus is doing powerful things. They're aware that there's spiritual activity. But the blasphemy there is that they think it's demonic, not holy. And, you know, Mark basically tells us that in verse 30. So, I mean, this is a tricky passage to preach on, but it does allow perhaps preachers to address some really unhelpful kind of interpretations of that and how forgiveness may or may not work. Because there's also huge forgiveness in the previous sentence about people will be forgiven all their sins. There's a panta in there in Greek. So every sin is forgivable apart from
rejection of
this utter rejection of Jesus, right? That's, you know. What would you preach on
Well,
this,
there's
friend?
Something about the dynamic here with the Satan against Satan, the sort of riddle that Jesus poses there, but I think it touches on the process that humans get into all the time of othering each other and accusing others of being something they're not, or, you know, dividing ourselves up, calling someone evil or outside the circle. There's something about our own tendency to do that that means we are divided. I mean, you only have to look at that at the local level in a newspaper, you know, but at the global level in the most devastating places.
in the world at the moment. So there's something there about name calling and labeling and categorizing in ways that divide and diminish, I would agree with. I think there is a link here to the Samuel passage if people want to preach across in a more thematic way around, again, the way humans seek, you know, there's a denial here of God's wisdom or of God's spirit. So there's something, there's a similar theme there about discernment and how we discern God in our midst. And here the point is a complete failure to discern the activity. So there's lots of passages, I think, of the book of Revelation that talk about the way evil mimics good. And we know traditionally, you know, Christians have been on the wrong side of history with things like slavery and apartheid because they've had a veil of Christian apologetics for them that's allowed people to kind of paint them almost as a God-ordained good, which we would now hopefully totally reject. But this is the other side of that coin, that there's a profound good that is being labelled evil and therefore not recognised. The other theme I thought of is in this little turn at the very beginning that goes from the family saying Jesus is out of his mind or Jesus is not acting like himself to the scribes labelling that as evil. And there's a whole pastoral sermon you could do around the way we label and stigmatize mental illness. So, I mean, I say that with some caution because if you're going to take that on, obviously it has to be dealt with really sensitively and carefully.
And it's only a side part of this.
Yeah, it's not story. The main it's theological. Not,
but it might be something that is pertinent.
But it could
where
be a
are.
Theme that yeah. for your community is, you know, a chance to actually address, in a way we don't often from the pulpit, but a chance to address the way we stigmatize you know, mental health issues as sometimes a spiritual failing, and to speak against, you know, to do some corrective kind of pastoral work there.
To go along with what I was saying about the division that we put ourselves into all the time, it's also very true here, quite clear that what Jesus represents is divisive.
Yes.
That you know, it breaks apart even that most basic, fundamental, crucial family unit in ancient life without which you are utterly bereft. I mean, nowadays we live far from our families in other neighbourhoods and, you know, sometimes we might be estranged for a whole lot of reasons. The family unit's less utterly crucial now, but then it was. And this, you know, his family are against him and they're still outside the house. That's a notable exegetical point here.
Yep.
They're still outside it. They're still in the middle of the story. They never get in.
No, and at the end in the, you know, where the story goes on beyond the lectionary, if you wanted to pick up that theme, the mother and brothers are outside still, as you say, and people point that out and he says, no, this is my family. So family sort of becomes, identity is completely reimagined in this story.
Yeah, as the Christian, well, the Jewish slash soon-to-be Christian community. There's also, we should finish, but it seems to me too, the stuff around change and desire for change in Samuel is here also being displayed here because the scribes don't want that. Like they're captive to the status quo and what they
There's resistance invest,
there's
to the
total
new.
Resistance to the new and this person who is outside themselves.
I like that. So resistance to the new even when it's actually the incarnation of God, is rejected.
Yeah.
Ooh, well, thanks, Fran.
That'll do. Thanks, folks.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.